You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Frank, thank you very much. Welcome, everybody, to The Exchange. I'm Tyler Matheson, and here's what's ahead on a busy Wednesday. Less than 60 minutes to go to the Fed's decision on interest rates. No move expected on that front, but the markets could move on what Chair Powell says. And our panelists are looking for some very specific clues from him today, and we will tell you what they are. Plus, Reddit, the first major mainstream company set to IPO this year in the tech area. And one of our guests says he wishes it wasn't. He's here to explain what he means by that and what it means for the overall state of the IPO market. And shares of Chipotle topping $3,000 for the first time ever on plans for a historic stock split. Can the company keep cooking up gains? That's all ahead, but we begin with today's markets and Dom Chu with some numbers. Hey, Dom.
They are numbers and they are in the green, but they are very modestly so. You can't get much more, Ty, in a holding pattern ahead of that Fed rate decision than we're at right now. So let me just take you through the percentage gains. It's about pretty much flat, flat, and flat for the Dow, the S&P, and the NASDAQ. The Dow Industrials currently at 39,158, up 50 points. That's the outperformer, up 0.1%. And we're pretty much spot on, up 2 points in the S&P to 5181. And by the way, just for context, again, very tight trading range. We were only up 6 points at the high of the session for the S&P and down 6 points at the low. So very much a tight trading range. The NASDAQ composite, 16,175, up an 8 modest points there. Again, pretty much flat on the session overall. We are seeing some movement, though, in some catalyst-driven, news-driven stocks, specifically with regard to the computer chip business. Intel, after the news of that big kind of chip grant, the $8.5 billion in loans and totaling $11 billion up to, Intel shares were up more solidly today. They're now down 0.2%. NVIDIA shares are down about 1% as well after its big developer conference and unveil of its next generation AI chip. Advanced Micro Devices down 3%. Micron reports earnings after today's closing bell. Keep an eye on that. And the semiconductor ETF ticker SMH just about down 0.1%. And then Tyler mentioned it, from chips to chips and guac. Chipotle shares did at one point top 3,000. They're at $2,903 right now, still up about nearly 4%, but up 8% at the high so far. Just to give you an idea, the 50-for-1 stock split obviously puts some of these shares closer to like that $57 to $60 range when they do kind of split adjust at that point. But Tyler, this is a company that's now worth roughly almost $80 billion. And just to give you an idea, it's not necessarily AI returns, but an up 80% over the year means it's now bigger than Target, the big box chain. I'll send things back over.
Holy guacamole. Dom, thank you very much. Let's start in Washington. Steve Leisman with what we should expect from the Fed chair and FOMC today. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Tyler. Yeah, I think it's possible the most important answer to the most important question of this meeting, when might the Fed start cutting rates, could come right at 2 p.m. in the statement, not necessarily from the press conference, from the statement. If the Fed repeats a critical line from the last announcement in January, they said, quote, the committee does not expect it will be appropriate to reduce the target range until it has gained greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably towards 2%. Well, they repeat that. It's going to be like going back in time, resetting the clock once again, telling investors they still don't have that confidence to cut rates, need additional data, maybe months of data showing declining inflation before they're ready to firmly telegraph any rate cuts. Along with the statement, new projections could provide clues to the policy outlook as well. They projected in December GDP at 1.4%, running a little hotter in the first quarter, 2%. Unemployment they projected at 4.1%. Well, they're creeping up to it towards 3.9%. Core PCE, you can see there, 2.9% in January, maybe 2.8%, 2.9% in February. So running a little hotter than their year-end forecast. And there's the Fed funds rate with that projection for a 4.6%. There is some concern that the individual Fed members, once they get done projecting it, could take off one of those rate cuts from the projection there and raise their outlook for the Federal Reserve funds rate for the end of the year. It would take only two members to do that. I'll leave it there, Tyler, throw it back to you. We'll look at the projections and also looking for some information perhaps on the balance sheet and what's expected to be the start of a discussion about ending that balance sheet reduction. Tyler?
I would love it if you would give us a little bit of a tutorial about a phrase that I'm sure is going to come up multiple times over the next hour and a half, and that is the so-called dot plot. What is the dot plot? Why is everybody paying attention to it? How often do they plot the dots? And walk me through it.
Okay, so the dot plots are the individual forecasts of Federal Reserve members for where they believe the federal funds rate should be at the end of this year, next year, 2026, and the long run. They take all those dots and they create a median out of it, and it's what is the general or average projection of the Federal Reserve for the funds rate that they set. The problem with the dot plot is it is confused for policy. You have 19 Fed officials, they give you the dot, it comes up with an average, and that average is 4.6, and people confuse that for being the policy of the Federal Reserve to reduce it to 4.6. It is not the policy. It is simply a derived average of 19 different Fed officials. You can kind of guess policy from there. Yeah, they look to be cutting. And if there are fewer dots at a lower range, it might mean that they're going to be projecting fewer cuts. But it doesn't mean that's the policy of the Fed. It's just their outlook, all things being equal, Tyler.
This is their forecast, in other words,
exactly.
A forecast of what's going on.
And you know what they say about forecasts?
Tell me.
Well, I was just going to use the joke about what they say about assume, right?
Yeah.
Put it this way, they're almost always wrong.
Almost always wrong. Steve, thanks very much. We'll see you a lot during the next hour here. Unanimity is the name of the game today. Next guests are unanimous in their view that the first cut in interest rates will not come until the summer and that Jay Powell will want the committee to be as close as unanimous as possible before that cut is actually delivered. Let's bring in Julia Coronado, who joins us on the phone, Macro Policy Perspectives president and founder, Subhadra Rajappa, head of U.S. rate strategy at Societe Generale, and David Balin, Citi Global Wealth, CIO. Welcome to all of you. Subhadra, let me begin with you and just get your sort of baseline view of what's going to happen today. And then what would be your outlier view? In other words, if the baseline doesn't come through, what would your next alternative be?
Yeah, so like Steve was mentioning, I think that the Fed might upgrade its growth forecast as well as its tick higher on inflation for this year. But really, the focus is going to be very much on the dot plot. So we're expecting that the Fed retains three cuts for this year. Our call is that the Fed will deliver the first cut at the June meeting and then stick to a one cut per quarter schedule for the remainder of the year. But really, the surprise for us will come if they move the dot for 2024 to suggest only two cuts for this year. And there's also a chance that both 2025 as well as the long run dot gets pushed higher. So that to us would suggest that the Fed is looking at a higher trajectory, a higher terminal Fed funds rate. And that, I think, would be a clear hawkish signal that the Fed is sending to the markets. And that, in turn, I think, would push Treasury yields higher.
Let me turn that same question to you, David, and ask you what your baseline scenario is. And do you agree with Subhadra that the possibility is a more hawkish tilt?
Well, I think the only place where I would take issue with that view would be, I think, first of all, the Fed may start, you know, one meeting later. Once they start, I think it's more likely than not that they're going to have a series of cuts. Right now, everyone's expecting three. That's sort of the average, right, of what people's views are. Once they begin to cut, having a regular systematic approach, you know, a sort of baseline of 25 basis point cuts this year and beginning of next year, I think is more likely than not as a baseline because they want to normalize their policy. The Fed tends to be an activist group. They tend to look at all the data from time to time. But once they get going, right, they want to be in a direction, right, where they actually begin, to normalize the curve and to normalize policy associated with buying back bonds, right, ending a portion of QT. Then the outlier scenario for us is the other way, which is the economy actually weakens more than we expect in the area of employment. And with that, I think we would see the Fed move a little more aggressively in terms of the amount that they might, you know, decrease rates at one of those subsequent meetings. So we tend to lean that way because ultimately the Fed's higher rates and QT, you know, is ultimately going to be a break on the economy. It's been wildly resilient so far. But when that break happens, the question is, you know, does it happen gently or do we see an actual more sustained decline in employment?
All right, Julia, let me turn to you and get your sort of baseline thought here. And if the Fed turns out to be a little bit more hawkish than we anticipate. What do you expect the economic response would be in terms of inflation and growth and unemployment? And what do you think the market's response would be?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So I think we all share a similar baseline that they'll keep it largely unchanged, but the risk is that they'll take a cut out. One of the conversations that's happening in markets and at the central bank is whether potential growth might be a little bit higher this cycle because of immigration, because of better productivity. That might signal a higher, longer run rate, and or it might lead them to take a cut out of not this year, but next year. So I think there's maybe an intent to balance the risks here by keeping the current baseline unchanged. Nobody thinks the neutral rate is 5.5%. Inflation's coming down. They're going to start the cutting cycle, but they're going to proceed carefully and cautiously, again, outside a deterioration in employment. They can proceed to be careful and thoughtful, as Chair Powell indicated, but they don't necessarily want to delay forever, because the longer you stay at this rate, the greater the risks are for that sudden turn that David just described.
Subhadra, how and why did we go from last year's forecast, where many people thought there may be 6 rate cuts in 2024 into 2025, now down to 3 or maybe 2? How and why did we get from that to this?
So, I mean, you know, full disclosure, we were in the same camp. We were thinking that the Fed could potentially cut rates by 150 basis points this year. We changed our call because the economy has been extraordinarily strong. I mean, the third and fourth quarter of last year, growth was very strong, and that momentum seems to be carrying into the first quarter. Jobs market, the labor market's extraordinarily tight, and inflation is high and sticky. So I think that's really what the market is recalibrating to, is a much stronger trajectory for growth. We've taken out our call for a recession for this year. So in that sort of context, it makes sense that the Fed cuts rates a few times, maybe 3. They might need to cut rates even to orchestrate a soft landing, in our view. So, but then 3 cuts might be sufficient for the Fed to provide some level of stimulus, but at the same time, make sure that there's a soft landing.
So, David, should we be happy if the Fed indicates that it may cut only 2 times this year or maybe 3 times this year? Should we be happy about that, or should we be, because it would suggest that the economy is growing nicely and unemployment is not rising all that much, if at all, or should we be worried because it would be a suggestion that inflation is stickier and more intransigent than we would like?
So let's deal with the inflation question first. I think there, you know, Citi's view, our view is that we are really in a situation where our highest confidence is that inflation is definitely going to be down at the 2.5% level, you know, at the end of this year, which is very much the Fed's target. There may be some, you know, noise along the way, but January and February were a little hotter in point of fact because price increases took place at that time. And we really see the vast majority of the inflation indicators heading down, with the exception potentially of fuel. And taking a look at the other side, right, of course, the economy, you know, we thought the economy was going to be slow then grow, that it was going to slow down now and accelerate. We just increased our earnings per share projections from 5% this year to 7.5%, which is a large change for the, you know, average stock for the S&P. And with that, we're, you know, building in the idea that the markets can go higher based on those earnings. But the Fed at the end of the day has to come up with a plan to normalize that rate curve, right, to actually see it, right, have an upward slope. And the longer it waits to do that, it actually adds risk to the market, and it takes away that possibility of resilience. And I think that Jerome Powell sort of said that at the last meeting when he said that the idea of normalizing, right, he doesn't have to wait for every signal in terms of inflation to be in place in order to begin lowering rates, because he knows that leaving them at this level with this level of QT actually is itself a danger to the economy.
That's very interesting. Julia, let me conclude with you to pick up on what David just sort of referenced there. And that is the idea that that the Fed might cut rates before. It doesn't have to wait for perfection. It might cut rates before inflation gets to 2%, not waiting until it does.
Yes, absolutely. The Fed still believes in long and variable lags in monetary policy. And Chair Powell has said point blank, if we wait till we get all the way to 2%, we will likely have waited too long. Again, nobody thinks 5.5% is the neutral rate, So this is not the right place to be once you've gained confidence that inflation is moving in the right direction. Some judicious cuts are in order, and likely, you know, when Chair Powell spoke before Congress in recent weeks, he said they need just a little bit more data showing that inflation is moderating. January and February probably didn't meet that bar. In fact, we had some firmness in January that was beyond expectations, but we do expect that March and April are going to deliver that downward trend on inflation. It's going to reassure the Fed, and they'll be good to go with the June cut. So I think Chair Powell is going to very much want to keep that on the table, very data dependent. But I think moving to a two-cut baseline would be probably a bridge too far.
All right, Julia Subhadra, David Balin, thank you very much. Appreciate your time today. See you again soon. All righty, let's turn to housing and another sign of just how sensitive buyers are to any movement in interest rates right now. Diana Olick has the very latest. Hi, Di.
Hey, Ty. Yeah, it's all in the weekly mortgage demand numbers. You see it there, and they're getting more and more sensitive to the small rate moves around bigger numbers like 7%. So mortgage rates rose last week for the first time in 3 weeks, and as a result, demand came down for the first time since February. The average rate on the 30-year fixed rose to 6.97% from 6.84. That was last week's average from the Mortgage Bankers Association. But if you take a look at the daily rate, and that's from Mortgage News Daily, you see that by Thursday, the rate had crossed back over 7%, and it rose even higher to start this week. So applications to refinance a home loan, which are most sensitive to weekly rate changes, fell 3% compared with the previous week, and were also 3% lower than a year ago. Applications for a mortgage to buy a home fell 1% for the week and were 14% lower than the same week a year ago. And interesting on those purchase applications, with housing supply still so low and prices still so high, the average loan size for purchase applications increased to the highest level since May of 2022, Tyler.
All right, Diana, thank you very much. Diana Olick. Coming up, Reddit expected to price its long-awaited IPO this afternoon. We will look at what Wall Street will be watching for and whether Reddit's path to profitability is the biggest wrinkle for investors. Plus, Box CEO Aaron Levy will join us exclusively on the heels of the company's Investor Day. Just made a big acquisition in the, yes, artificial intelligence space, and we'll ask him about that and why he thinks AI will create more jobs instead of replacing them. 43 minutes until the Fed decision, folks, on interest rates. The exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Astera Labs surging in its public debut today, up 69%. The chip firm priced its IPO at $36 a share and opened at $52, giving the company a $9 billion valuation in total, biggest IPO since ARM went public back in October. At the same time, we are waiting another big IPO expected to price after the bell today, and that would be Reddit. Leslie Picker has all the details. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, Tyler. Yeah, that performance should bode well for Reddit, just given it shows that there's momentum in the IPO market. Reddit, though, very anticipated IPO. It's been 827 days since Reddit announced it had confidentially submitted its paperwork to go public. It appears, though, that that long-awaited day is nearly here. Reddit is expected to price its IPO after the close today with a trading debut tomorrow. It sounds like the discussions are leaning toward pricing at the high end of the range it had been marketing, about $34 per share. But there are still 4 hours to go before that final decision call, where the bankers, the advisors, the company all gets together and decides a final price for this IPO. Reddit has been marketing a price point between $31 and $34 a share, which implies a fully diluted valuation as high as $6.4 billion. That's a 36% decline from the $10 billion valuation Reddit received in a 2021 private funding round. In the prospectus, Reddit calls itself a, quote, global digital city where 73.1 million daily active users collaborate through different communities with common interests. The headlines, just while the company was on its roadshow over the last week and a half or so, encompassed a letter from Nokia alleging infringement of some of its patents, an inquiry by the FTC into Reddit's agreements to share content with third parties to train AI models, and in talking with investors, some of them were surprised that Reddit, despite being a two-decade-old company, was not yet profitable and that the pursuit of profitability had upset users last year leading to a short blackout during the summer of 2023. But others see, you know, the markets are doing well. The S&P near record highs, a company that has decent top line growth, very decent of 21%, and a scarcity of new issuance as a reason to buy in. Of course, there are certain tailwinds we see from Astera Labs as well, given that performance today. So we'll see what happens this evening and tomorrow with trading. But so far, we've seen a pretty decent test in the IPO market today. We'll see if it kind of carries over for Reddit.
For Reddit, yes, that would be, if it does well, it certainly would augur well for the IPO market generally. Mm-hmm. Leslie, thank you. Our next guest predicted Reddit to lead the mainstream wave of IPOs back in January, but he says he wishes some other company was leading the charge. Let's find out why from Duncan Davidson, partner at Bullpen Capital. Duncan, welcome. Good to have you with us. Why would you prefer to see another somebody other than Reddit sort of in the at the point of the spear here?
It's because of all the skepticism of Reddit. I hope it's a successful offering. But the most ironic part of this is one of the biggest Reddit communities, Wall Street Bets, has sentiment which is highly negative of the IPO. They think it's going to be a pump and dump situation, not a sustainable situation. And I hope they're wrong.
They say short it, right?
Yes, the sentiment's highly negative.
Yeah.
It's kind of ironic, I think. But if it turns out it captures their attention, then it turns into what people call stonk, a meme stock, and it could run up like crazy. But I do not expect that to happen, nor do I expect a pop. I think it's going to price high, as you said, but I think it's going to be a little bit of a volatile offering given the range of sentiment on it.
Does the Astera Labs IPO tell you that, hey, this is a good time to go public? And if Reddit has a good debut, does that say, hey, IPOs may start coming to market at a greater pace?
Well, I would like to say that, but I'm not sure. Astera is trying to ride the AI wave. It's not really an AI stock, but it's certainly getting bought by data centers that have a huge demand from AI. Reddit's arguing it's an AI company, but it's really not, because it's selling its data to, in this case, Google, maybe later OpenAI, ChatGPT, but it's not really the core of what it does. It's not AI. So you're seeing the market really is hungry for AI. It's not quite as clear it's that hungry for social.
So let's talk about social there for a minute. Here, this is a company that has something like $800 million in annual revenues. I think I'm right on that. I'm not sure. But how do they not make money?
Well, their argument is they haven't really tried. They're now trying very hard. They're going to be $1 billion of revenue next year, if you believe their plan, $1.2 billion after that. This offering on the surface looks amazing. This is a number three social site with attention in the world after Meta or Facebook and Google. It should be doing much better. Professor G, who a lot of people read and I find very entertaining and very insightful, thinks it's got 100x upside. Well, I don't think he's a good stock picker, but this thing does have upside. If they actually go toward profitability and keep growing, this thing could at least double or triple from where it is at the offering tomorrow. I just don't think that'll happen quickly. There's a huge overhang in this company of private investors and some at higher prices. So more likely, I would recommend to people, watch this thing. If it doesn't become a stonk and go up like crazy, I'd just wait till after the overhang, the six-month lockup's over with, and then I'd look at buying it and holding it as a serious long-term play.
Was it smart of them to offer the stock to their so-called Redditors?
I think it is. I mean, it does create some volatility risk in terms of retail investor going in and going out. But their community is their strength, and they need to feed and support the community. The community is actually very skeptical of the advertising model because that doesn't like ads. But having said all that, I think the community in the end will, Wall Street Bets notwithstanding, will support their own company here.
Duncan, always great to have you on. You always speak your mind. Really appreciate it. Very clear. Thank you. Duncan Davidson.
Take care.
Bullpen Capital. Yeah, same to you. All right, let's talk about Chipotle hitting an all-time high, briefly crossing $3,000 a share. That's a lot of bowls of Mexican food right there. First time after announcing a 50-to-1 stock split. We're going to look at the next steps later on in the program. The Exchange returns after this.
Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Bertha Coombs with your CNBC News update. The U.S. is warning that foreign hackers are targeting water and sewage systems across the country. In a letter to state governors, the administration warned that the attacks were perpetrated by Chinese and Iranian hackers in particular, citing a case of a downed facility in Pennsylvania. Cybersecurity professionals have singled out water and sewage plants as targets because of the critical service they provide and their lack of adequate defenses. The Environmental Protection Agency issued new rules to curb carbon emissions from vehicles today. In a push toward EVs and hybrids, the new rule says as long as 56% of new vehicles sold are electric by 2032, the auto industry could meet its carbon emission limits. The EPA says the rule will avoid over 7 billion tons of emissions over the next three decades. And the Mega Millions jackpot is close to $1 billion ahead of Friday night's drawing. The pot has been building for 29 straight drawings now since December's last winning ticket. Current jackpot, $977 million. They're going to have to rewrite that old song, Tyler. You know, if I had $1 billion,
yeah, exactly,
instead of just a million.
I still got a chance here. I'm going to go out and buy one.
Go for it.
Bertha, thank you. Coming up, Box CEO Aaron Levy will join us on the heels of the company's Investor Day. In the past, he's opposed the overregulation of artificial intelligence. We'll ask him if he still feels the same way. That's next. Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Shares of Box up more than 10% this year, outperforming the S&P as the software and data and content management company shifts to AI. Box counts 67% of the Fortune 500 as among its customers, and it is working on implementing an enterprise-grade AI into its offerings, enabling businesses to use it safely and securely. Joining us now is Aaron Levy, CEO and co-founder of Box. Aaron, good to have you back on CNBC. We appreciate your time.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Great to be here. How is AI going to change your business, which I think is broadly defined as the content management business? What is it going to allow you to do? Is it effectively Act 3.0 for Box?
Yeah, so we're incredibly excited. We're entering effectively a new chapter for our company. With Box, enterprises manage and secure some of their most important documents and content. So think financial records, marketing assets, contracts, product designs. So all of this unstructured data today that really powers how businesses work. With AI and with this new chapter that we're entering, we can fundamentally transform the insights that you can get out of all that information. We can help you automate more and more of the critical business processes in your enterprise and keep your data more secure. So for the first time ever, AI is able to actually go through this content and deeply understand and synthesize the underlying information that's in this data. That was never before possible with our unstructured data or our business content. And so this is why we think it's a massive breakthrough where we can turbocharge productivity for employees, we can automate back office operations more, ultimately give people back more time to be able to do what I think we're best at, which is building amazing products, serving customers. These are where businesses want their employees spending their time.
I guess what I'm hearing you say, and I am a dunce when it comes to AI, but that your business, which was in the business of managing, storing data, now it with AI, it will allow the user, the company, to use that data, manipulate that data, access the data, and bring it alive in ways that are not just storage per se.
That's exactly right. So just I'll give you a really simple example that I think will resonate quickly. Imagine that you are a B2B company and you have a large sales team, and your sales team needs access to answers quickly about what products are selling or competitors in their industry. Today, within any kind of knowledge-based environment or content management environment, the sales rep or the engineer on that account would have to go and find exactly the document that has the answer that they're looking for and then be able to learn whatever the information is. With AI, you just ask a question of all of your data and instantly get an answer back that will go and accelerate whatever that problem is that individual is solving. This has literally never been possible before. So all of a sudden, we're taking the power of all of this content in an enterprise and turning it into real-time knowledge and insights for anybody across the organization. And so what we specialize in is making sure that that's safe, that it's secure, that you only are getting answers back from the data that you personally have access to. So there's no way for you to ask a question and get answers back that you're not supposed to see. But just think about what this can accelerate in life sciences and healthcare and financial services, for any kind of go-to-market team in an organization. So you can really tap into the underlying knowledge inside of your organization.
And I can go in and find out the precise paragraph in a contract, for example, that I need to help me understand. This is where the acquisition of Cruise comes in, right? An acquisition you did about a month or so ago. It helps you vault into this area.
Yeah, so we're basically combining the power of Box AI, which is a platform capability that connects to leading AI products like OpenAI or Google or IBM or others. We're taking the power of the ability to extract structure from your unstructured data. So take a contract, for instance, be able to take out all of the key variables from that contract that you care about. And then with the Cruise acquisition, now you can actually automate the viewing of all of your contracts across your enterprise. So now you can run reports on, show me which contracts are up for review or up for renewal. Show me all the contracts with risky clauses in them that you might want to pay more attention to. So all of a sudden, you now have the ability to get business insights from all of the data in your organization. And Box really never could have provided that before, but frankly, it was never possible before the role of AI emerged inside of enterprise software.
Quick thought on AI and jobs. A lot of people worried very much about the idea that AI is going to eliminate lots of jobs. You have a much more nuanced and, I would say, optimistic view of that. Could you give us it in a thumbnail?
Yeah, so hard to do in a thumbnail, but basically, I think that humans do way more inside of our daily jobs than simply rote tasks. And what AI is incredibly good at is automating those rote tasks. So what email should you send to a customer? How do I extract data from a contract? How do I automate an invoice process? That's where AI is going to be incredibly powerful. It's going to streamline how we go and serve customers, how we drive our supply chains, how we avoid risk in our organization. That will give back time to employees to do what we do best as humans. And when you think about a company, let's just say even Box, for instance, if we could make our sales reps more efficient, if we could make our customer support agents more efficient, we're actually going to grow faster, which means we're going to hire even more people in those functions. And so I think AI actually will drive growth in organizations that will allow them to reinvest even further in really the human side of the work that we're doing. So yeah. I'm an extreme optimist on how AI will help augment the human aspect of work, and it'll actually be a net boon to job creation over the long run, because all companies are striving for more growth to be able to serve customers better, to drive more innovation, and AI is an accelerant to all of that. Yeah.
More growth typically means more people. Aaron Levy, thank you very much. We appreciate it. All righty, coming up, Intel receiving more than $8 billion in grants alone, courtesy of the CHIPS Act. We'll hear from Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger next. Intel is in line to receive as much as $8.5 billion in grants, on top of billions more available in loans from the CHIPS Act. But shares are down 30% since CEO Pat Gelsinger took the helm 3 years ago. And here's what he told John Ford about Intel's turnaround.
We have taken our investors on a journey. You know, we said very clearly this is 5 years to turn the company around, 3 years into that journey, and now we see the light at the end of the tunnel. We would hope to be manufacturing the most advanced AI chips for all of them, for Intel's products, but for AMD and NVIDIA and Apple and Amazon and Google. We want all of those chips to be manufactured in America, taking advantage of the R&D that's done here uniquely in America as well.
And you can watch more of John Fort's interview with Pat Gelsinger on Closing Bell Overtime today at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Still ahead, it's one of the biggest stock splits in New York Stock Exchange history. Chipotle shares breaching $3,000 apiece for the first time on news. The board approved a 50-to-1 stock split. The timing and what history reveals about returns next. All right, welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Shares of Chipotle climbing to an all-time high today after it announced its first ever stock split, pending shareholder approval at an annual meeting in June. And it's not just any split. a 50-to-1 split, one of the biggest in the history of the New York Stock Exchange. The fast casual brand on a tear, up nearly 85% over the past year. The share price is currently just above $2,900. That means if the split were approved today, shares would go down and trade about $58 a piece, but you'd have 50 more of them for every one you own today. Joining us now to discuss is Nick Setyan, restaurant analyst at Wedbush, and our very own Kate Rogers. Kate, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
What do you think of this stock split?
Well, I think exactly what you got at. The stock has gotten quite expensive for investors, and Chipotle wants to make this more accessible, not only for individual investors, but also it mentioned employees in its announcement yesterday. I think two other notable things, which I'm sure Nick will hit on, but they did announce a one-time special grant for general managers of their restaurants and also for employees who have been there for at least 20 years, right? So they really want employees to take part in the financial success of the company, and that's a big part of this.
Employees have been there 20. I didn't even know Chipotle was 20 years old.
More than 30.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I do think that's notable. And Chipotle obviously talks a lot about investing in its employee base. General managers is a position that they widely tout. You can move up to that role within 3 years and make over $100,000 with benefits. So this is just another example, right, of what Chipotle is doing.
So Nick, we'll get to the question of the stock split in just a minute. But this is a company that is on fire by a sort of any measure. The increase, what do we say, 80% so far this year? I mean, that's just insane. How are they doing it?
Well, first, thanks for having me. You know, I've personally been very surprised at, you know, the continued traction it's getting with many of its initiatives. You know, particularly the main innovation has been, you know, extremely successful. The carne asada, you know, was a big driver in Q4. It was a very big driver in Q1. Now they've, you know, shifted to chicken al pastor in the middle of March. Hopefully that's, you know, as big of a contributor. Now that, you know, the labor is no longer much of an issue, they can focus on speed of service. So throughput, particularly during those peak hours, is a big driver as well. A lot of technology initiatives, again, focusing on throughput and efficiency. And obviously the marketing has been very effective as well. And then last but not least is the loyalty program and a lot of the digital initiatives.
And Nick, how much interest do you think retail investors will wind up having now at a much cheaper price? I'm thinking also about younger investors, right? People love to invest in what they know. Chipotle's been such a hit.
This would be on my son's list, by the way.
Exactly. Yeah. So what do you think about that?
I do. I mean, I think there's definitely going to be a lot of incremental demand, right? If just practically speaking, if you're investing $500 a month, you know, on an ongoing basis, as an example, and you want to buy a specific stock, Chipotle, you can't do it if it's trading at $3,000, right? So, you know, this is just practically speaking going to allow many more people to participate in the story.
Do stock splits affect returns in any measurable way, or is it really a non-event?
You know, I don't think it impacts the fundamentals. Therefore, I don't think it impacts the returns. I mean, I think there's a correlation just because usually you see stock splits with successful companies, right? Unsuccessful companies don't tend to have stock splits. So, yes, I mean, there is a big correlation. I don't think there's causation.
Yeah, it's not causation. In other words, the healthy companies are the ones who are doing the splitting. Mm-hmm. So they might, you would expect, do a little better than those that don't.
Right.
Yeah. So let's talk about what's next for this company. You know, is it menu innovation? Is it better use of digital approaches or drive through or what? What is their next chapter?
I think it's all of the above, right? I mean, I think you are seeing the you know, AI-enabled digital, right? I mean, whether it's customer information, how you use that customer information, how you understand that customer information, how you set up your drive-through, how you know, you speak to customers once they go through that drive-through, how you speak to customers when they're opening up your mobile app. I mean, I think there's a lot of opportunities around that within the store. You know, there's a lot of technologies. Like avocado cutters, et cetera, in terms of automation. So I think there's a lot of opportunities there, you know, in terms of the marketing messaging, right? I mean, I think there's still a lot of opportunities there. They still spend only around 2.5 to 3% of of revenues around, or, you know, marketing expense. I think there's opportunity there. So all of the above, yeah. Man, I think there's a lot that could drive success.
Got to leave it there. Got the Fed coming up. Got to go. Thanks, my friend. Nick Setyan, appreciate it. Same to you, Kate. Good to have you in the house.
Tyler, great to be here.
All right, that does it for The Exchange. The Fed decision just a couple of minutes away. That would be about 6.5. Courtney Reagan will join me for Power Lunch in just a moment. We're just going to pick up on coverage on the other side of this quick break. I'll be right back.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.